which means glorification, really, or describing the fame of Krishna, the all-attractive Supreme Personality. What better fame to discuss? So much fame, so many personalities. Today we were at Sea Point and we were filming some people, and I was looking at them and I thought many of the people that were not being filmed looked much more interesting to me than the ones they were filming somehow or other, without meaning to discredit those people. But everyone has a story to tell. Everyone has a life which is often much more interesting than some staged movie. Mm-hmm. But when that life becomes a spiritual life, then it becomes really meaningful. Because spiritual life leads to our eternal credit. So the chanting is like that. It may be appreciated as music for its form. It may be taken as this very nice sound, but it goes much further. It really awakens something in us, something that was deep asleep, but that we always knew was there. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prem Sadhikabunai Shravana Lisudhichitta Kariyutai. This chanting awakens our original consciousness and the original love that is there within the heart of every living being, but that somehow or other we cannot really harness at present, that love, which will awaken in relationship with Krishna and then with all living beings, will awaken through the chanting. So without further ado, we'll begin. Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jai Advaita Chandra Daya.
Shatatvamakam Krishna Bhakta Rupa Sarupakam Bhakta Vatara Bhakta Kyam Namami Bhakti Shaktikam. That the Panchatattva appears out of the Lord's causeless mercy. Krishna himself, he really has other things to do than to deal with materialistic people. I think there's a book coming, no? Someone ran out the door. Yeah. And down. Anyway, the Panchatattva appears in this world because Krishna is in Vrindavan and performing his transcendental Ayushtin Braj. I used it at Yudhavara. Yes. So Krishna is in Vrindavan in his eternal abode. And why would Krishna bother with the miseries of the material world? People praying, oh Lord, please cure my sneeze. oh Lord, I'm so bored. You think really that Krishna is going to deal with death? Forget it. Would you deal with death if you'd have to? I don't think so. I wouldn't. If I didn't have to, I wouldn't. Absolutely not. So why would Krishna, who can do whatever he likes, why would he bother with all these kind of things? He doesn't. He's the Supreme Lord. He is spending his time with the blissful souls. Naturally, I would too. Why would you spend your time with sour grapes? Forget it. So Krishna is absorbed in his transcendental sweet pastimes in the spiritual world, where life is fun eternally. And then he expends himself. Nityananda means always blissful. It is specific mercy incarnation. Nityananda is ready to deal with anyone and anyone, anytime. Doesn't matter who it is. Nityananda deals with rogues, murderers. He approaches them and is ready to transform them. So Lord Krishna is absorbed in his eternal pleasure pastimes. But then one day, Krishna was thinking to himself, for long I have not come into this material world and have given love for myself. And wouldn't that be really a wonderful thing? So Krishna decided to descend into the material world, not expand himself like he does many times. Yes, if we would be God, we would not be limited by one form. So he is anantarupam, he has unlimited forms as he likes. He can expand himself. But he chose to come in his own original form. And in that form, he came in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who took sannyas. And that is what we are hearing this. Ei sukalagi ami karilan sannyas amar sarvanase toma shabar parihas. Have I taken sannyas for such happiness, accepting this oil would bring my ruination, and all of you would laugh. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu declared himself a strict sannyasi. A sannyasi is not supposed to take help from anyone. Retaining a masseur to give him massage would indicate his dependence on others. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted to follow very strictly the principle of not accepting anyone's help for his bodily comfort. So Jagadananda was a great devotee. And Jagadananda was a devotee with a very strong individualistic mind. Jagadananda had a temper, and Jagadananda had his own ideas of what service he wanted to render. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in this world, the Supreme Lord, but now playing the part of a devotee, now in the dress of a sannyasi, but the Supreme Lord without a doubt. Then Jagadananda wasn't going to be bothered with this temporary external feature. He was more interested in the eternal, into the true nature of the Lord, not that what he showed to people here on earth who were all entangled in their own network of karmic activities, of trying to enjoy the fruits of their labor and squeeze some enjoyment out of the material world. And to deliver those people, the Lord sent so many messengers. The Lord comes so many times, in so many forms, again and again. And a few living beings take advantage of the message. But most say, thank you very much, that was really nice. Yes, I'm very inspired, and nothing changes. Everywhere in the world, wherever there are prophets, wherever there is scriptures, there is lip service as well. Yes. Who actually gives his heart? Who actually changes his life? Who actually is brave? No one. Everyone is calculating, yeah, well, you know, it's nice to change my life, but then I lose so many things, and these things are dear to me. Therefore, the Lord sends endless prophets. Endlessly, he comes himself in expansions, so many forms. But sometimes he comes in his original form. So now he came in his mercy form. He came especially to bestow mercy upon everyone. That is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So although externally he was acting as a sannyasi, dressed as a sannyasi, Jagadananda understood the real truth. Therefore, he did not follow the principles of sannyas, but offered the Lord a big jar, a big clay jar with scented oil. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu refused to accept it. And said, you give this oil to the deities, right? Not to me, what will I do with it? Jagadananda became so angry that he took that oil, went outside of the room, went to the courtyard of the house, and smashed the jar with great force on the ground, and it made a loud crash. And everyone said, what happened, what happened? Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to see what happened. And Jagadananda said, nothing happened. Nothing. And then he went home and started fasting and refused to eat. So, after some days, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sent his servant to Jagadananda and asked him to come and cook. So that he did. Then he cooked. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took some of that cooking and then asked Jagadananda to take the remnants that he did. So, in this way, the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had the transcendental vision. They could see his transcendental nature. It's always like that, that there is a minority that can see. Minorities can see the Supreme Lord, can recognize him. Others, they don't. They don't. Somehow or another. Of course, there are many. Just as in the rainy season, of course here in Cape Town, you don't particularly have a rainy season. It always rains. But in India, they have a rainy season, you know? And then for a period of time, and then it comes down really serious, not just a few drops, buckets and buckets. And so for 8 months or 9 months, the land becomes very, very dry. And then the rainy season comes and suddenly all these plants appear and lakes appear, puddles appear, and all kinds of animals take birth in that water and so on. And at that time, the sky is clouded and you cannot see the sky and you cannot see the stars in the sky. But you see, at night, glowing luminaries in the sky. And some people think these are stars. Whereas others realize, no, these are simply fireflies. Fireflies. So there are many fireflies also that claim to be incarnations. So many. That is to be expected. But they must really do something extraordinary, to be recognized as the Supreme Light. Krishna, 5,000 years ago, clearly acted like the Supreme Lord. Krishna didn't turn old, for one thing. Right? But that's sort of, more than human, than most of us, sort of, over time, lose it. But not Krishna, because when Krishna was under 25 years old, he still looked like 16. Which is kind of exceptional. That was the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Krishna was still fresh and young. So Krishna is known like that. So many qualities in Krishna. Well, let me backtrack a little bit, because I started in the middle, and in the middle of Krishna's transcendental activities, and that may be a little too much for some of us. So let us begin. Even mathematically, it would be difficult for everything in this world to come about by chance. Just because of the great complexities in the organisms, in nature, or in all the endless arrangements in the universe, for all that intricate arrangement where one thing is so dependent on another to come about by chance, mathematically would be difficult. They say there's not enough time in for the existence of the universe for all that to come about by chance. On the other hand, another mathematician named Stefan Unwin did a calculation of the chance that God would exist, and he came to 69%. There's a book. I've got the book because, I thought that's interesting. Can be useful. It's all mathematics, so you have to be a mathematician, but, it's hard. Hard calculation, 69%. So, over a whole, what can I say? God scores well. That's a fact. So, not that I'm trying to convince anyone, it's up to the individual. But personally, I find it a good indication that they're seeing all this complexity in the world. There must be something. At one point, they concluded like that. And then, when I thought about it, it's that something. In due course of time, I came across the philosophy which says that God is a person. And it says, and why wouldn't God be a person when everywhere in his creation it's filled with personalities? My dog is quite a personality, if you know what I mean. Yes. Not like any other dog. I mean, he has a character, isn't it? So even dogs have personality, cats, whatever, everyone. A bird has personality, it's an ant, it's like, as you're all sitting on the floor, I many times sit on the floor in a lecture in India, and in India India is somewhat densely populated, not only with people, but also with insects and animals and everywhere. And there are always ants everywhere. So as you're sitting here, there's really nothing going on, but in India, there's these big ants, and some have like these tweezers on their nose, and they look serious, And then one comes straight at you, So what you usually do is you sort of with your finger just shoot it sort of back, And it goes like 1 meter back. It turns around and comes exactly the same direction again. Stubborn like anything, Of course, if you play tennis with the ants, you send it to your neighbor. Who then sends it to his neighbor. And these kind of things are going on. What can I say? So even an ant has a personality, quite a personality. Talking about ants, ants are interesting creatures, I would say, because ants, right, ants are always working. Have you noticed it? Any time. Did you ever see some ants lying on the beach, you know, like sunglasses on and sort of, ever? Never. Ants are always working, always, yes. So, why? What are they working for, you know? What are ants working for? Anybody can help?
A queen. A queen.
Huh? What? Huh? What did you say? Queen?
Queen. Queen. For the queen.
Ah. Not, I didn't say who are they working for. What are they working for?
Sugar.
Ah, sugar. Sugar. Sugar, sugar, not bread. Ants want, don't want bread, ants want sugar. Yeah, that's for sure, sugar. But, you know, like, I read an article about what they do with the sugar. You know what they do with the sugar? They make alcohol out of the sugar. Is that interesting? You can't just imagine. Some people are going to come back as ants. You know? So anyway, now we know. They take it very serious. So, in this world, everyone has a personality. And then say, like, yeah, but God, no, he doesn't have personality. That would be ridiculous. If there's a God, how can he have personality? That's ridiculous. Yeah, and come on, you know. We're not going to be anthropomorphic, are we? You know, projecting human reality upon the divine. Isn't that primitive? Isn't that sort of like what primitive people used to think, that there is something, somebody up there, like down here, as if it's the same up there as down here? Well, but are you saying that we have something that the Almighty doesn't? And then he's not so almighty, doesn't it? So if everyone has personality, sorry, the Almighty, who's so mighty, he doesn't have. So, therefore, I thought, yeah, why not? I guess God is also a person. Why not? Okay, well, then I thought, what's next? What would he, if he's a person, what would he look like? You know. All right, pictures of God. One time I was traveling in the Juno Mirage in the car, and the sky was all clouded, and suddenly there was like a hole in the sky, and like sunlight was just beaming down, and Maharaj said, look, God. You see these kind of pictures, you know? That's nice. Yes. So what does he look like? That's the question. Michelangelo painted him, old man, beard. I don't know. I mean, if I was God, I wouldn't look like that. Why would you, you know? Why would you look like that? God, we don't want to look like that. I don't think so. If I was God, it's up to you, but if I was, I would just be very beautiful. I wouldn't have glasses, for example. Honestly speaking, you know, I would throw them away. And yeah, a little younger also. Yeah, bring the eyes out a little, get rid of those rings, and adjust the nose a little. I would make some adjustments like that, what can I say? Yeah. Who wouldn't? If you could, who wouldn't make a few adjustments? Just anybody, practically. Okay, a few things, little adjustments. So yes, the Supreme Lord is unlimitedly beautiful, but not only like the sort of the sort of artificial external beauty that is kind of cosmetic, but beauty that also reflects his beautiful nature, his noble nature. So we're dealing here with true beauty. Now, beauty is an interesting thing, because beauty suggests that somebody is very exalted. If you see some very beautiful person, then you think, God, this person is very, very noble and exalted. Not necessarily so. That in this world, not always. But on the spiritual platform, yes. So, that's Krishna. So really, when we read the scriptures about Krishna, we see qualities that are just amazing. Amazingly beautiful, amazingly noble. And you know, when something is very nice, suppose you have some ice cream that is like extremely good, you know, very creamy and with like a delicious sauce on top and just like, you know, little bits of nutty crunches and some little very sweet ripe mango, you know, to sort of add on some whipped cream as well, of course. And gradually it's getting good, right? Gradually it's good. And by the time you taste it, it touches your tongue, and what will you say? You'll say, it's divine. Oh, what's it like? It's divine. Right? Because that's the definition of divine. Something like out of this world, you know? It's divine. Yes. So if God is not divine, then what's the point? Right? I mean, so he must be divine. He must be extraordinary in every aspect. Just amazing. Mind-blowing, you know. Must be mind-blowing. Otherwise, what's the point of having a God? That doesn't make sense. He must be divine. And that is exactly what we're talking about when we speak about Krishna, the all-attractive. When we study Krishna, then we see he looks all attractive. He's also playful. He's not terribly serious, right? He is serious, but also playful. And that makes it much more, attractive than just when everything is very serious. Now, we're dealing with God. Well, it's getting serious. Because we're dealing with God. No, why? You know, he's fun also. Why not? He jokes. He does. He has a sense of humor. Which I think are all important qualities. Right? So when we are looking at Krishna, then we see all these qualities in the personality of Krishna. And all these things sort of make him attractive. He's sensitive, but also a free spirit. Yeah. So all these things are attractive. Isn't there more of this? So that's my first point. I will not belabor the point. But my first point is that if you check out the descriptions of Krishna, then you find a person that indeed has so many divine qualities, and that makes him the all-attractive. So yeah, that's sort of... that was convincing, I must say. When you ask someone, how do you know that Krishna is God? How do I know? I mean, how can anybody know? Yeah? Somebody one day decides to have a haircut and leave a little bit at the back and smear war paint on his forehead and start jumping around the totem pole and or something like that. Beat bongos and, you know, and just stand on the street corner and people look at it like, oh my God, you know, what went wrong in your life? that kind of thing happens. So, what is it that brings people to that point? Well, it made sense. The personality Krishna, the whole description of Krishna made sense. Not from that immediately I could say, I've seen the light. I hadn't seen the light at all. Yeah. But I saw that here is a system of belief that is consistent and that depicts a picture of divinity that indeed is divine in quality. You know, that is just amazing and attractive. And shouldn't it be like that? So in that way, it made sense. And then behind it, there was a theology which also was logical and made sense. It, for example, could explain injustice in this world as being, you know, like, why are some people born with all the support and all the facilities, and why are others, like, taking birth in an antisocial environment and are kicked around as a football from their baby days and it never gets better? Why? Karma was the answer. Well, karma is something that sounds so fatalistic. Right? Karma sounds something like, well, you just accept your karma, you're stuck with it, and that's it. No, because it's also your karma that you can do something. So karma doesn't mean fatalism. It simply means that all previous actions have a reaction, that currently we can act according to the facility that we have from that karma, you know. I sometimes tell the story how I was in Calcutta with a friend of mine, and, you know, I said to him, I said, Calcutta, you know what I mean? The black hole of the universe, right? It's known as that, you know, the black hole of the universe, because everything is black. Yeah, somehow or other, there's so much smoke in Calcutta from the coal and so on. Everything is black. So the paint, the walls are painted, and they're black, right? So it's walking in Calcutta, black, you know what I mean? So it's go like the black hole of the universe. I said, and my friend goes, what do you mean? What do you mean? Calcutta, beautiful city of gardens. Beautiful city of gardens. And my friend was 2 meters tall, and he could look over the walls, and all I could see was the walls, you know what I mean? And he saw a whole different city than I did. Karma. Different karma. And I'm destined to see black walls for the rest of my life. And as tall guys can see what's on the other side. In some cases, of course, you don't want to see what's on the other side, to forget. Anyway, you get the idea. Karma. Different karma, what can you do about it? But it is due to previous activities. So if someone in a last life has misused things, has exploited, then in this life he will get less. If someone was overcome by greed and took more than his share, next life he'll get less than his share. If someone was angry and terrorizing others, then in this life he'll be terrorized. Maybe a thundering fire. Karma. So that felt like that, not only a description of the Supreme that makes sense, but also a whole theology behind it that is consistent and makes sense. Then you have a system of belief. And then you can say, well, this system is consistent, so something to it, I think. And one has initial faith based on that. And take a step. And don't we just take all decisions like that in life? Like, you know, like empiric, scientific, hard evidence. Before you get married, you know, do you do a full scientific analysis of the wife, the spouse to be? Everything, you know, you do like a full screening on her history, everything. There is a detective job completely. Then you send her to a psychiatrist, get a foolproof report, you know. What else can you do to her? Medical checkup, you know, just to make sure that, like, yeah, you know, you don't marry a case that's going to be in the hospital half the time. Yeah? Yeah, it's serious. Could easily happen, you know. She might be beautiful today, but then I'm speaking from the male perspective, but from the female perspective, it can be the same. You marry some guy, do you know who you're marrying, you know? And you just sort of look at the person and twinkle, twinkle star and smile and think, well, yes, I think I'm going to do it. On what basis did you just decide that, you know? I mean, where in the world, right, did you get that self-assurance from, that faith to make the jump? Well, you got some indications. So in the same way, in the spiritual sense, when one gets many indications, yes, then I think, yes, I'll try it out. Then there's a process. It's interesting. The good thing is that when you have a tradition, you have a system of belief, you have a process, and you follow that. And when you follow it, you will find that that you get some experience, you see. So the experience that you get is what is more convincing. It's like confirmations. And that way, over time, one becomes deeply convinced, and one's faith becomes stronger and stronger. And because the faith is stronger, one is ready to invest more in spiritual life, naturally. And the more we invest, the more the returns will be. So then one gets deeper and deeper experiences. Like, that's kind of how spiritual life works. So with that, we wound up with Krishna. And Krishna, he plays a flute also. And in an amazing way. Because Krishna is such a musician that he speaks through that flute. His heart speaks through that flute to the heart of others who actually get the message. Because even in this world, a good mundane musician can touch the heart, can penetrate right to the heart, touch our heart. So Krishna actually can speak through his flute and touches the heart of his devotees. But that happens on the spiritual platform. So the spiritual platform is like that, full of variety, full of taste and reciprocation. It's not just, you know, and then there is light. No, that's not all. There is light, but there's also variety. But it's imperfection. You see, there is this funny idea that comes from philosophers. Philosophers have a great influence on society at large, but somehow or other the world doesn't realize it. But philosophers, their thoughts, they proliferate into society. So look at this argument. Whatever is spiritual must be the opposite of material. Logical or not logical? Whatever qualities you find in the material can therefore not be there in the spiritual. Obvious. Therefore, when there is form and variety in matter, then in spirit it cannot be. Logical. Logical from where we are now. Logical, but maybe not necessarily not necessarily true. Maybe not the only logic. There are so many types of logic. There's also the logic of Plato, which we find in the story of the cave. You may remember that the prisoners were chained in the cave and there was a fire in the back, and people would, and they were with their back towards the opening of the cave, and all they could see was the inner wall of the cave. But because there was a fire, and if people would walk past, they would see shadows on the wall, and they would also hear the noises of the voices. And that was it. So that was part of life in the cave. They'd been there so long, they just saw shadows and noises and so on. And one day, one person got out of that cave and saw the real situation and said, actually, these shadows are not the real, it's not the real thing, that's just the reflection of the original thing. So even in Plato's writing, Socrates is the hero, even there we find this concept of that matter is a reflection of spirit. Interesting, we find the same in the Vedic literature. So Vedic literature is telling us that when we see variety and form here, that it's a reflection of the original. And that in the original world, it's the perfect form. Yeah? It's the perfect situation. And here it is the, we all know the imperfections. We try to hide them from each other, but everyone has. So this is the... situation. It's a reflection. The world, but this world is a reflection. So a reflection can tell you something about the original. Therefore, by investigating the world, you get an idea about the spiritual reality. But there it exists in a better form. Yeah. Here you see love, right, in the world as like a highly glorified ideal, you know. Love is a very splendid thing. And things like this, you know, dramatic statements. So love is highly glorified. She loves you. Yeah. So, you know, love has been known many times, as a glorious thing. But where does this love exists in a pure form in this world? You also see the movies, you know, like they love each other so much, and then he goes to war and something happens to his face and he comes back and looks like a monster. You know, and now what, you know? Oh my God. And then after a while it gets a little difficult, you know, to live with the monster. Something has died inside. Yeah, something has died. That love is no longer there. somehow to do. Anyway, we know the movies, you know. Yeah. We've seen these movies. So that sort of shows love in this world is not complete. There is a selfish element in it. But real love must be completely selfless. So that is on the spiritual platform. That's spiritual, that's the original. So what we see here in this world is the reflection, and the reflection is somewhat imperfect. So we see the elements of this world exist in the spiritual world, but in a sublimated form, in its better feature, in its original feature. So that is interesting, because we see that we have some deep desires. For example, who's ready to die? Anybody tonight particularly ready to die? Or would you say, rather wait till tomorrow? Or the day after, if possible. Or if you could choose even next year. Who votes for next year? So it's like, no one wants to die. So, why is that? What's the big deal if we're just chemicals? Why are you so worried that your chemicals are going to mix with some other chemicals? If you're just chemicals, big deal. So we can see that this fear of death is something. So yeah, because the soul is eternal. Soul, death is alien to the soul. So how can you die? It doesn't make sense. No, that's not me. Yes, I die. No, not me. I'm eternal. I can't die. Yeah, you have to. Everyone dies. No. Maybe everybody dies, but I don't think I will die. No, I'm not going to die. I can't, because it doesn't sit right with me. I really feel that I'm not going to die. Yeah. Never going to die. No, the song. That was part of Born to be Wild. What can I say? So yes, we see in the world, we see these tendencies to live forever. Because we live forever. That's our nature. The soul lives forever, the true nature, see. Therefore this spiritual knowledge appeals to the heart. Nature would say, yes, exactly, it appeals to your heart, and therefore you create some God so that you can feel comfortable with it. But we say, Mr. Nietzsche, when I was thirsty and had this deep desire for some drink, there it was, cool water that quenches that thirst. When I was hungry and I wanted some food, Mr. Nietzsche, there it was, yummy, yummy. Do you want any more? No, I'm fully satisfied. Yes. So to all of my desires, there was an answer. Where there was a man, there was woman, and where there was woman, there was man. So all desires have an answer so far. But that one desire, Nietzsche says, no. Yeah, your religious desire, that's just speculation. That's just your weakness, and therefore you have to create some shelter. Yeah. That's a weak argument. A weak argument. No. Everything in our nature finds an answer. Also that. So in this way, it all makes sense. And it's just the world that has become influenced by philosophers. I was reading in Darwin's biography. You know, why not? And nowadays you can download everything from the internet, you know. You can check it out, the Gutenberg Project. There are so many old books available, you know, in ebook form, downloadable in any format, and sure enough, you know, there I found Darwin's biography. Well, I downloaded it straight away and started reading. And at one point I came to an interesting point where Darwin said, you know, he said, you know, if there's one thing I can no longer tolerate, he says, it's art. It's art. He says, it's just, you know, it's trying to make something out of this world, you know, and that's not there. He said, like, even like poetry, you know what I mean? Then he said, you know, even Shakespeare, you know, I mean, for an Englishman, you know, it's a big thing, you know. And, yeah, even Shakespeare, I can't hear it anymore. I can't hear it anymore, you know what I mean? Because after all, we're just, you know, biochemical origin. Why read all this mystic, magical dimension into life, which is what art is all about? A mystic dimension, you know what I mean? He said, I can't tolerate it any longer. And then he said, but sometimes I think that maybe I'm missing something. It was really good, you know. I mean, I'm quoting it not exactly as good as I remember, but it's an interesting passage. You know, Darwin's moment of doubt. It's interesting, you know, that even Darwin had a moment of doubt. So yes, it is true. I have a story that I was on a boat, and it's a big one. We had rented it, 3 masts on it, sails, and, you know, like 32 cabins, double decks, you know, it's a serious thing. And people came to look at it, and on top were the Hare Krishnas, and with rocking music. I guess I was singing. And people were sort of coming, you know, and just checking it all out. And then after that, I came off the ship onto the shore, and there was a big crowd. And one man came up to me and said, you know, I also have a big ship. You know, I said, oh, really? I said, yeah, an ocean sailor. And I could hear his accent. I said, where are you from? He said, from Holland. I said, I'm also from Holland. Oh, God, you got to see my boat. I said, sure, you know. I went on board this thing. It was indeed a 30-meter yacht, you know, a serious thing. And on board, and he goes, like a sailor do, he goes, what you want to drink, you know? I said, water. So I had my water, he had his wine. And then we're exchanging the drink. And he says, you know, I was going with this ship over the Atlantic. He said, you cannot believe. When I saw the sun appear from the ocean, I've never seen anything like that. So beautiful, so amazing. Oh, something else. He takes a sip of the wine, turns around and says, and what went wrong in your life that you, you know, became a Hare Krishna? And I said, ho, wait a minute. Just only minutes ago, you were on your knees for the sunrise, you know. You were like just almost religious right there, speaking about the sun rising from the waters. You were almost praying, you know. Why? Just some gas, you know what I mean? Some gas and some water. Why would you get so emotional about it? Why do we get so emotional about the world? Oh, springtime. Oh, butterfly. Oh, rhododendrons. Sounds good in the poem, doesn't it? Rhododendrons. the humdrum of the rhododendrons. Or something more meaningful. Like a bird on a wire. Like a drunken midnight choir. I have tried in my way to be free. Yes, so poetry.
So, why so much poetry?
Why? Why all these things? Because why a sense of aesthetics? Because there is a hankering within us for an other dimension. There is a hankering in us for more than just the mundane. There's a hankering in us, a natural hankering in us, for a greater spiritual reality. Therefore, it's obvious. It's obvious. That there is something there. It's quite obvious. Obvious. So it's not such a big jump, actually, when we're not just totally brainwashed, hypnotized, or, you know, people that have lost it, or, you know, just sort of victims, you know, from the funny farm. You know, instead of being cuckoo, we found a new one.
Irish, yeah.
Not like that. No. That's a bit too simplistic. A bit too simplistic. There really is more to it. Yeah. So there's a science, a spiritual science. It's not cheap. It's not just sentimental. It's not just so simple, you know. Oh, we used to think, you know, these are very simple people. They stand there on the street corner. Ching, ching, boom, ching, ching, boom. It looks like, you know, nothing up there, right? Absolutely nothing. You know, just sort of repeating the same sound over and over. Right? It's like hollow, something hollow in the head, you know. But it's not quite like that, actually, to be honest. Yeah. Not at all. It's actually a lot of substance, a lot of depth. A lot of thought, a lot of answers to a lot of questions, perennial questions. I mean, questions about life, questions about our individual nature, questions about the world that we live in, and good answers, answers that make sense and that connect to something deep inside of us, that connects to our natural innocence. Huh? Remember children? Children, they are, in some ways, they're much more sensitive. They don't like animal slaughter, for example. Yeah? Children seem to have some sort of purity that adults lose, as we know, isn't it? You know, you see it in children seem to have that. Yeah. That was us. Yeah. What happened? What happened? The system got to us. We were drilled. Oh yes, we didn't want it. Sit still. Okay. You know, you got the righties. How many times did I have to write, like, what do you call it in English? These punishment lines, you know? How do you call it in English?
Lines.
Lines? Just lines, huh? Okay, in Dutch they call it punishment lines. Oh, God, the two pens, you know? And double pens, two pens in one hand, like that. You never did that?
Oh,
okay. You know? Oh yeah, well that's how you do it, you know. Two pens. Take two pens at the same time, then you're twice as fast. Some could even do with three, but I never managed that. Two pence I could do. Yeah. All these things. We were pushed into it, you know. I mean, just as we're walking on the along the sea at Sea Point today, there were some three girls on skateboards, right? And one of them, you know, they all get down their skateboards, and then one says to the other two girls, "Okay, guys, I'll be done for today." And it's like sort of kids, you know? And you're thinking, wow, you know? She's got it all worked out, right? Cool little chick, you know? Hey, guy. At that age already, you know what I mean? Gosh, you know? She's ahead of her days. That's how it is. At one point, we figure it out, you know, how to be cool, how to cut the profile, how to just, how to speak, how to act, how to play the role, and what's left of us, our true self. And like this, we've become disconnected from who we really are. And now we can reconnect with our true self. You know, and get over that sort of grinding dissatisfaction that sort of that we've been trying to forget for a long time. But that was there in school, that was there in university, and you thought, soon I'll be graduated, soon I'll graduate, and then, you know, and then you get a job, and then you realize, I wish I'd never graduated. Soon I'll be married, and then you're married, and you think, soon I'll have children. And then you'll have children and think, I wish I freedom. Where is freedom in this world? So somewhere we became disconnected from our real self, and therefore we always feel caught in every situation. But this process can reconnect us. We reconnect us with ourselves, where we belong, in a world with an all-attractive supreme, in an all-attractive exchange. That, I'll tell you what, at the end of the day, fairy tales are true. After all. And you thought all along, it was just myth, didn't you? There was a time you believed in fairy tales, didn't you? But then on the way, kind of lost that belief. But today I tell you, fairy tales are true after all. And they lived happily ever after. There we go. So with that, I'll end now. You have to end on a high note. Any questions? Any comments? So a lot of people can feel a promise that there is more. And that is why there are many people are willing to try things, and this is what we ask, only one thing. Try chanting Hare Krishna. We have a lot more, but we won't ask you that. That you have to ask us. All we ask is chant Hare Krishna. And then whatever else we have and we know, you have to ask us. Then we'll tell you. as simple as that, because by just chanting Hare Krishna, everything will be attained, everything. As simple as that. And chant, not only chant once, chant every day. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour. In the beginning, with music, or without, softly reciting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, again and again. Slowly, gently, like the waves of a gentle stream that will slowly enter into the stream of our mind, which is just sort of flowing here and there in different curves, and the mantra will just enter into that stream of our mind and just purify those polluted waters, that so many things floating about in the stream of our thoughts. But slowly the mantra enters into that stream and begins to purify. Try and chant every day. That is our request.